Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, July 4th, 2018. We begin with the news section. The Tattler's Tale. Did the Montessori School of Raleigh fire a beloved teacher because she talked to the cops? On May 16th, the day police arrested Montessori School of Raleigh headmistress Nancy Arischetti on charges of aiding and abetting alleged sexual abuser and former middle school teacher Nick Smith, more than two dozen parents fired off an email to the school's board of trustees begging the board to rethink what they believe to be one of Arischetti's most inexplicable decisions, the sacking of Janie Jackson. 2 weeks earlier, Jackson, who had worked at the school for 9 years, including the past six as directress of MSR's Children's Home 2, that's pre-K through kindergarten, had learned that her contract would not be renewed for the upcoming school year. Jackson was one of six teachers whose contracts weren't renewed. Several of them, including Jackson, had previously gone to the board to complain about Arischetti's leadership style, and one of at least 16 teachers who won't be returning this fall. As parents of Children's House 2 students, the parents wrote, "We were both surprised and concerned to learn of this decision. We firmly believe she embodies the values of grace, integrity, and leadership we want the Montessori School of Raleigh to instill in our children. Many of us have already enrolled our children for next year with the understanding that Janice would continue as their teacher." The parents never found out why Jackson was terminated. Like Jackson, they were only told that she no longer fit the school's culture. One Children's House parent says a board member told her there was something they knew but couldn't tell us. "We absolutely didn't believe it. Nancy was feeding them BS reasons. It was so frustrating. I know for a fact that Janice is a very honest person, very upfront." Her wrongful termination lawsuit filed last week in a Wake County Superior Court, Jackson posits her own theory. She was fired, she claims, after the school learned that she'd been assisting the Raleigh's police investigation into Smith and Arischetti. Smith, a longtime math teacher, was indicted in November on 20 counts of statutory rape and child pornography stemming from an alleged year-long sexual relationship he had with an eighth grader, identified in court documents as Jane Doe 1 in 2011-12. He is currently in the Wake County Jail on a $3 million bond. In January, Jane Doe 1 and her family filed a lawsuit against Smith, Arischetti, and the school, alleging that Smith had also sexually abused Jane Doe 1's younger sister and that the school knew about his inappropriate behavior but didn't take action. In May, in a potentially precedent-setting prosecution, the district attorney's office indicted Arischetti on charges of aiding and abetting Smith, a felony, and contributing to the delinquency and neglect of a minor, a misdemeanor. Arischetti has stepped away from management of the school. Although her contract was up for renewal at the end of June, the Board of Trustees declined to take any action while the charges against her play out, according to a school spokeswoman. MSR is currently searching for an interim head of school. On Monday, Arischetti's scheduled arraignment was postponed for the second time. Jackson says she first spoke with Detective Alice Doughty 10 days after Smith's arrest. Then, and in a follow-up conversation in December, she relayed some disturbing stories she'd either witnessed directly or heard about secondhand. Her first red flag, which she described to Doughty, came in 2010, when Smith accused her then 13-year-old daughter of making him uncomfortable. Jackson says she wasn't told that her daughter did to make him feel that way. Years later, after Smith's arrest, Jackson's daughter told her about a time before that when Smith had taken her off campus in his car while blaring sexually explicit rap music. Jackson also told Doty about concerns raised by a teacher named Carolina Eidson. In August of 2012, soon after Arischetti became head of school, Eidson sent her an email detailing reports of inappropriate behaviors between Smith and female students. In that email, Eidson described Smith hanging out late into the night in girls' hotel rooms on overnight trips and being alone with and holding hands with Jane Doe 1. In an email, Eidson declined to comment. In addition, Jackson told the detective about an end-of-year faculty party in June of 2015 held at MSR's middle school campus, in which a retiring teacher named Subhash Patel regaled the audience of about 50 with a story about a school trip to Europe, Jackson believes, when Smith took students to a nightclub or a bar and got so drunk that Patel needed to come pick him up. Patel did not return a phone call, but another former teacher who was there seconds Jackson's account. When she heard this, Nancy put her fingers in her ears and said, "La, la, 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 I don't want to hear this," Jackson said. It's difficult to know how seriously people took this exchange. Jackson admits many of the faculty members had been drinking, and a lot of people laughed. "But there were some of us that looked at each other like, 'Whoa,'" Jackson says. "We didn't really have enough information. You don't know how much was embellished." After she spoke to the police, things carried on as normal, Jackson said. On April 19th, she was given her student roster and classroom assignment for the 2018-19 school year, according to the lawsuit, an indication that MSR planned to keep her on. But then, as a part of the discovery process in the civil suit filed by the Doe family on April 28th, the school received a summary of Jackson's interviews with the police. 6 days later, Jackson was told she wouldn't be returning. She said she wasn't told why, after 9 years, she no longer fit the school's culture. "I was a mentor for numerous teachers. I was put in leadership positions. I was the chairman for a committee on reaccreditation as a result of that work," Jackson says. "I mean, it just doesn't make any sense." In a statement, MSR Board of Trustees Chairman Joel Lee denies that these events are related. Mrs. Jackson's lawsuit wrongly attempts to tie her employment status to a tragic and unrelated event in our school's history. The decision not to renew this teacher's contract had absolutely nothing to do with her cooperation with the police. "From the very moment of Nick Smith's arrest, we encouraged everyone, students, parents, staff, faculty, and alumni, to go directly to law enforcement if they had any pertinent information to share." Jackson's case doesn't rest solely on the coincidental timing of her termination. It also involves conversations she says that she had with Kathleen Malik, an MSR parent and the sister-in-law of a board member, in May. In the first of these conversations, Jackson says Malik explicitly told her, "What we have been told was that you were not renewed because you went to the police." The next week, Jackson says, Malik told her she couldn't help her get reinstated because it's tearing my family apart. In an email Friday, Malik denied telling Jackson she was fired for talking to the cops. "I did not say any of those things attributed to me in the lawsuit. I was disappointed to see these false statements in the lawsuit, and I look forward to seeing the truth come to light," she wrote. She did not respond to follow-up inquiries seeking additional information. However, in a letter of recommendation, Jackson's attorney says Malik gave Jackson on June 4th, Malik praised her child's former teacher. "Nobody is more dedicated towards the improvement of our kids than Jeannie Jackson. In her eyes, she represents the best of the best when it comes to integrity and ethics and doing the right thing." Asked about Alex's denial, Jackson says, "She's in a horrible situation. I can't even imagine what is going to happen to her family now. So I understand why she's doing what she's doing." In the wake of Jackson's dismissal, says the children home parent, the majority of children have pulled out of Children's House, too. The amount of people who withdrew their children is unbelievable. Read shortly before press time, an MSR spokeswoman couldn't immediately confirm or deny this parent's account. I got a text from one of Janie's parents asking me about withdrawal deadlines because a lot of parents are planning on leaving, a former longtime teacher told the Indy Tuesday Morning. Tuition for Children's House is $10,450 for a half day and $17,290 for extended day. This according to the MSR's website. As a part of the Montessori program, parents expect their children to have the same teachers for three-year cycles to allow the teachers to get to know the kids socially, emotionally, and academically. It's a major selling point of the model. So it's not surprising that amid such upheaval, some parents would look elsewhere. The students that would be with us for another 2 years, their parents were shocked, Jackson says. I have letter after letter after letter from parents saying that they were devastated. The next news article, here comes trouble. Should a poor HUD designation give the Durham Housing Authority cause for concern? The CEO of the Durham Housing Authority says the agency is appealing for a second time a low assessment score that deemed the authority's public housing operations troubled for 2016. The DHA was notified in April that it had been designated troubled by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's Real Estate Assessment Center, which reviews public housing agencies, finances, management, and housing conditions. The assessment covered 2016 and gave DHA's public housing program 57 out of 100 possible points. Agencies that receive scores of 60 or less are deemed troubled, the lowest designation. The 2016 scores are the most recent available. The designation continues a decline in DHA scores as it prepares to undertake a redevelopment of most of its public housing stock. The agency has been considered a high performer in 2013, then dipped to a standard performer in 2014 and 15, with high scores in every area but physical condition. In 2016, DHA received a perfect score for its finances, but scored 19 out of 40 points for the physical conditions of its buildings. It received a management score of 8 out of 25 and a capital fund score of 5 out of 10 points. It was the management and capital fund scores that landed DHA in troubled territory. Vacancy rates inform both scores. CEO Anthony Scott says the agency could not have had as many vacancies as it did if not for plans to redevelop its public housing units through HUD's Rental Assistance Demonstration Program, or RAD. It's on these grounds the DHA is appealing the 2016 score after already having one appeal rejected. RAD was created to help public housing agencies make up for what HUD estimates is a $50 million backlog in needed improvements. Locally, DHA estimates its public housing units need $19 million in basic repair, although major fixes like new roofs, plumbing, and HVAC systems are also needed. The program lets housing agencies convert units to the more stably funded Section 8 voucher program, borrow money, which they traditionally have not been able to do, and partner with private investors. Former DHA CEO Dallas Parks, who left the agency 2 years ago, planned a full-scale renovation of all the public housing sites through RAD. So when residents moved out, the agencies kept their units vacant so other residents could move in temporarily while their own units were being redone. However, under Scott, who became CEO in June 2016, RAD plans have changed. Two sites, Marine Road and DeMar Court, are being gutted, while the rest will be rebuilt in phases as mixed-income and, in some case, mixed-use neighborhoods. Because plans changed, DHS lost or withdrew RAD contracts, known as CHAPs, which lay out broad plans for a site, but more importantly, start the clock ticking on tight timelines to arrange financing and get to work. Property with CHAPs aren't factored into public housing assessment scores because it's understood that the agency is working to improve them. So when DHA lost those contracts on some of those sites, those vacancies were suddenly counted against it, although DHA still intends to convert the properties. The trouble designation is basically a consequence of not putting these units back online quick enough when they went from wanting to go from full RAD to partial RAD, an HUD spokesman Joe Phillips told the ND last week. Scott says the agency was not aware that creating vacancies to prepare for HAD would have this effect on its assessment score. He expects the agency will again be deemed troubled for 2017 because those vacancies still existed in properties not under RAD contracts. Prior to receiving the latest score in April, the agency hired additional contractors to more quickly get vacant units ready to rent, and it expects to improve occupancy rates within the next few months. We have clear evidence that we were already working toward this, Scott says. As of May 31st, there were 137 vacant units, with the highest number, 34, at Oldham Towers, a senior housing site. Meanwhile, there are nearly 2,000 households on the waiting list for housing, according to a presentation made to DHA commissioners. Phillips says DHA's designation would remain until the next annual assessment. Scott says having to fill those vacant units, rather than keep them open in anticipation of upcoming RAD renovations, is not a significant setback for redevelopment plans. Work is underway at Marine Road and Mar Court, and while DHA recently selected some development partners to work with these downtown sites, it has not decided which property they'll focus on first. The agency is trying to determine which would be the best contender for crucial low-income housing tax credits, with the aim of beginning construction on the next site in early 2020. Because we won't be developing all of the properties downtown at the same time, I don't think we have the same concern the authority had under the old model, Scott says. The trouble designation only becomes a significant issue when a housing authority is considered chronically troubled. The designation doesn't preclude DHA from participating in RAD or other programs. Generally, HUD considers an agency's score for both its public housing and Section 8 operations when approving grants or programs. DHA's Section 8 program is considered a high performer. DHA has until July 15th to submit a proposed plan to HUD that will form the basis of binding recovery agreement. The next article from the Soapboxer, Pigs and Slop. The General Assembly knows better than those silly jurors. Big pork must be protected. On Sunday, State Representative Jimmy Dixon, a Republican from Duplin County, published a remarkable op-ed in the Goldsboro News Argus, reacting to the $25.1 million verdict that came down against Smithfield Foods Friday in the second of 26 scheduled hog farm nuisance trials taking place in Raleigh. Dixon, an unabashed Smithfield apologist, lashed out at the plaintiff's lawyers who are trying to rape these families and have raped and prostituted their clients, and Judge Earl Britt, who doesn't have his thumb on the scales. His sorry ass is sitting on the scales. End quote. Family farmers, he argued, were under attack. We the people must continue to rally and demand justice for the property rights of our hard-working family farmers. And we must do it in the court of public opinion because we are damn sure not getting justice in Judge Earl Britt's courtroom. For years, this is how Dixon and other big port allies have framed their debates over the noxious odors and swarms of buzzards and pests that the mostly poor, mostly African-American neighbors of the state's hog farms have complained about. As the meager family farmer being beaten down by the greedy out-of-state lawyer who was willing to burn and pillage North Carolina agricultural industry in his quest for lucre, only they, the brave souls of the General Assembly, stand in the way. In 2013, about 500 neighbors of farms that raise Smithfield pigs sued the company, alleging that the farmer's method of waste disposal, which involved open-air cesspools and spraying liquefied waste onto fields, infringes on their right to enjoy their property. Weeks later, the legislature vastly expanded the protection it affords agricultural operations and eliminated a provision that said that nuisance protections don't apply to negligent operators. Then in 2017, after the lawsuit survived Smithfield's motions to dismiss, Dixon pushed through legislation, over Governor Cooper's veto, that dramatically narrowed the amount of compensatory damages plaintiffs in future lawsuits could collect. Dixon tried to make this retroactive, effectively negating the cases against Smithfield, but he couldn't get enough Republicans to go along. And in this year's short session, which opened a few weeks after a jury in the first Smithfield trial rewarded 10 plaintiffs more than $50 million, the legislature went to bat for Big Pork again, this time with Senator Brett Jackson, himself a farmer, spearheading the farm bill. Whereas, it began, frivolous nuisance lawsuits threaten the very existence of farming in North Carolina. A federal court, the bill continues, had incorrectly interpreted state law, and now the legislature, regrettably, is again forced to make plain its intent. Its intent, it seems, is that the neighbors of the spraying of the hog farms, not just the farms involved in the Smithfield litigation, but the more than 2,000 hog operations across the state, could have almost no legal recourse. Under the bill passed last week over Cooper's veto, would-be plaintiffs have to live within half a mile of the alleged nuisance and can't file a lawsuit in most cases if the farm had been in operation for more than a year. In addition, plaintiffs couldn't recover any punitive damage if the farm in question hasn't previously been slapped with a criminal conviction or civil enforcement action over the alleged nuisance. Given the state of North Carolina's under-resourced regulatory apparatus, one attorney for environmental advocates points out that substantially limits, if not eliminates, the possibility of punitive damages. It's not like industries in North Carolina aren't already shielded from angry juries. For two decades, the state has had a strict cap on punitive damages that will render the first two verdicts against Smithfield a relative slap on the wrist. For first judgment, for more than $50 million, has already been reduced to just over $3 million. The most recent verdict, for more than $25 million, will come down to $630,000. There are, as the plaintiff's attorneys have argued, proven steps Smithfield could have taken to address these issues. The company just didn't want to spend the money. These juries wanted to send the company a message. Thanks to the legislature, however, that message is but dirt to be brushed off Smithfield's shoulders. To recap, step one, crack down on how much bad actors can be sued for. Step two, crack down on who can be sued. Step three, crack down on compensatory damages. Step four, crack down on who can sue and who can receive punitive damages. Add it all up, Big Pork can do whatever it wants. And contra Dixon's rhetoric, it is Big Pork we're talking about. Farmers don't have the resources to upgrade their waste disposal tech. Smithfield, a multi-billionaire Chinese-owned conglomerate, does. Make no mistake, this isn't about bucolic farms and family farmers. This is about power and money protecting profits and shareholders. Don't let Big Pork's pawns pretend otherwise. We turn now to the indie food section. Baller Melon. Peak North Carolina watermelon season is here. Learn to pick like a pro and see what local restaurants are cooking. Watermelon is an iconic summer food. It's the perfect choice for a potluck picnic dessert, an essential part of any barbecue spread, and a refreshing poolside snack. For many of us, watermelon recalls childhood memories of hot summer days, munching ripe ruby slices, juice dripping down our chins. Raise your hand if, like me, you ate down to the rind and scraped off every bit of pink flesh with your front teeth. Even though it's perfect on its own, watermelon is a versatile ingredient and can be enjoyed in many ways. In the South, folks like to sprinkle salt on their slices. The combination of sugary watermelon with a dash of salt, be it sea, kosher, pink Himalayan, or table salt, yields an irresistible sweet-savory combination. Mint is a classic addition to watermelon drinks, where it lends a crisp, herbaceous foil to the fruit's sugary sweetness. Watermelon can also cross over to the savory side. On a Carolina beach trip 3 years ago, I ordered my first watermelon and feta salad and swore I'd never eat it in any other way. And the North Carolina Watermelon Association's online recipe arsenal proves that watermelon can go beyond salads, featuring recipes for watermelon soup, tacos, lettuce wraps, and pizza. There is even a recipe for Parmesan roasted watermelon rind, a part that I previously considered inedible. I've also since discovered that in the South, rinds are often pickled. Watermelon may be a summer-long fixture, but it's especially delicious in July when it hits peak season in North Carolina. There's even a designated Watermelon Day at the State Farmers Market. This year's event will be held on July 26th and will feature free slices, recipes, and the largest watermelon in North Carolina contest. Last year's winner weighed in at more than 237 pounds. But what everyone really wants to know is, how do you pick a melon that hits the trifecta? Ripe, sweet, and juicy. The National Watermelon Promotion Board confirms the oft-repeated advice to use color and sound as your guide. A melon should have a creamy underside. The yellower, the better. It should sound hollow when you knock on it. But if you prefer to leave the selection and creative preparation to the pros, here's where to munch and sip your way to watermelon-induced bliss at restaurants around the Triangle. Panzanella Salad at Whiskey Kitchen. Downtown Raleigh's Whiskey Kitchen gives savory watermelon salad a fresh spin, pairing locally sourced melon with smoky mozzarella cheese instead of feta. Chef Clayton Anderson lightly cold-smokes siligrine, soft, rich, and creamy balls of mozzarella to impart a subtle, smoky flavor that tamps down the melon's bright sweetness. Melon and mozzarella make a fine pairing, but Anderson takes things firmly into the summer territory by adding the duro to panzanella. Panzanella is a traditional Tuscan tomato and bread chopped salad that was created to revive pieces of stale bread, which eagerly soak up the juices of summer ripe tomatoes and olive oil and vinegar dressing. Here, watermelon cubes and mozzarella balls are combined with chunks of heirloom tomatoes and buttery croutons crafted from Trebecca Bakery baguettes, then dressed in red wine vinaigrette and garnished with fresh basil. Next, watermelon rosé sangria at Nanatako. Sangria knows no seasonality and is practically synonymous with party time. But when the wine is rosé and the fruit is watermelon, it adds up to a refreshing summer sipper. Although diners at Durham's Nanatako start asking for the watermelon road sangria in spring, but the seasonal libation isn't available until summer. It's best enjoyed on the patio with a trio of tacos, a big old plate of nachos. The sangria was created by owner Jennifer Gilley, who drew on her bartending background to transform sangria, which can be cloying, into a balanced, nuanced beverage. Instead of chunks of fruit, Gilley starts with watermelon agua fresca, a refreshing non-alcoholic fruit beverage that's popular in Mexico. To make things boozy, she combines it with Laurent Miguel Rosé, a dry French wine, and silver tequila, an unaged tequila with sharp flavor. To add its citrus and spice and everything nice, she mixes in habanero, simple syrup, fresh orange and lime juices, and a dash of salt. To tone down the sweetness and add effervescence, Gilley tops her creation with rosé cava and garnish it with a cilantro sprig for a pop of color. Watermelon Cooler Cupcake at the Cupcakes Bar. Since 2008, the Cupcake Bar in Durham has earned a following for its specialty cupcakes, whose flavors are often inspired by owners and sisters Anne Branley and Katie Brom's favorite cocktails. July's menu will welcome back the perennially popular Watermelon Cooler Cupcake, which was inspired by a watermelon and mint tipple Branley discovered at nearby Gear Street Garden. For the cupcake base of the cocktail-turned confection, Branley and Brom start by sourcing locally grown watermelons from Lyon Foam Farms or the Durham Farmers Market, then make a watermelon puree. They discovered that if they replaced the milk in the cupcake batter with puree, they could achieve a delicate watermelon flavor without thinning it out, which would result in a soggy cupcake. The watermelon cupcake is then topped with mint buttercream frosting and pieces of fondant fashioned to look like watermelon seeds. Also from the food section, Best in Smoke. Behind the scenes of competition barbecue with champion pitmaster Shannon Turner. The incoming text from Shannon Turner reads, "We are in spot 29-2 or 3 from the start of the big rigs. We have a Raptor." I walked down Salem Street, which had been blocked off for Apex's annual Pig City Pig Fest, a Kansas City Barbecue Society-sanctioned competition. Behind the promenade, I spy a row of RVs, including one emblazoned with the word Raptor. When I see the smoker set up next to it, I know I'm in the right place. Turner introduces herself, and after she sees me gawking at the equipment, explains that it's a stick smoker that weighs about 1,200 pounds. I see why the RV and the smoker's trailer in the tow are necessary. Plus competition barbecue, which requires monitoring and smoker's temperature overnight, takes Turner all over the East Coast. So it makes sense she'd sleep in something that could pass for a tour bus. Turner and her husband, Brian, make up the competition barbecue team, Muntly Crew BBQ, named after their five dogs. Technically, anyone with a cooker that cooks meat low and slow can call themselves a pitmaster. But there's more to being a pitmaster than throwing a rack of ribs on the grill. The pitmaster is a person who's a leader, Turner explains. It's a person who makes the right decisions, the person deciding which meat goes into the box to go in front of the judges. In competition barbecue, teams submit entries for four categories: chicken, pork ribs, pork, and beef brisket. The pitmaster must be able to cook several kinds of meat at once using multiple techniques. Control the smoker temperature, Turner's is between 275 and 300 degrees, and make the food taste and look as good as possible. This is a whole new ball game. We use brines, we use rubs, we use injections. We have gadgets to monitor the temperature, Turner says. We don't know how much better we can go through it, but it's a lot. Turner starts by filling the smoker's fuel box with charcoal, and then continually feeds in wood. First hickory to imbue pork butt and brisket with strong smoky flavor, then applewood, which imparts a mild fruity smoke flavor to chicken and ribs. When the sauces aren't the typical bottom variety, Turner orders several pro-grade sauces, which are richer and glossier, and combines them into her signature sauce, heavy on the tomato, with a vinegar kicker. Once the meat is cooked, Turner tastes, inspects, and selects samples to deliver to the judges. Every half hour within a two-hour block, competitors have a 10-minute window to turn in meat using an insulated box. KCBS-certified judges critique barbecue based on presentation, taste, and tenderness. For chicken, Turner adds rubs and sauces to give drumsticks a sweet heat flavor, but she's careful not to mask the flavor of the meat. And the chicken doesn't look too juicy, lest the judges think it's undercooked. For ribs, Turner looks for a clean bite, so the meat must easily pull away from the bone, but not come off completely. For pork, Turner slices, or chops, meat from the money muscle, nicknamed for its reputation for winning competition and prizes money, then adds a finishing rub or sauce. For a brisket, Turner decides whether she wants to turn in burnt ends of slices, perfectly tender slices drape over her fingers without breaking. To boost its visual appeal, she'll add black pepper, a finishing rub, or drippings. Cooking award-winning barbecue takes practice. Muttley Crew has participated in over 100 competitions, but the Turners didn't win their first grand championship until last year around their 75th effort. Then they won two more, along with a few Grand Reserve championships, second place overall, and placed in individual categories in multiple contests. These results help qualify Turner for the 2017 Cowboy Charcoal Fire and Ice Championships, which crowns the best female pitmaster among the 10 highest-ranked KCBS female-led teams. To determine the winner, 50% of the competitor's score comes from a KCBS contest in which the pitmasters cook with their teams, while the other 50% come from a separate contest between the women. Turner recruited her sister to help. Turner presented a looks take on steak and potatoes, grilled wagyu filet mignon topped with a blue cheese garlic chive compound butter, served with grilled asparagus and Hasselback potatoes drizzled with red pepper jelly. Along with Muttley Crew's solid performance, the dish crowned Turner the 2017 Fire and Ice Champion. The necessity of gender-specific competitions is often debated, and I wonder what Turner thinks about it in the context of competition barbecue. Turner credits contests like Fire and Ice for bringing awareness to the fact that female pitmasters exist. Before, you may have walked through a contest and not realized that that woman is a pitmaster, because typically, they're not all women teams. You might have some, but for the most part, it's men and women. Turner insists that regardless of the designation, pitmaster's gender, Competition Barbecue is a team effort. But when Mötley Crüe places in a competition, she's more likely to hear her husband's name called because she's a woman. People don't assume that she's a pitmaster. I think people may assume, right or wrong, that if you're first starting out and you're a woman pitmaster, they go, "Oh, well, we'll see how this works out." There's a lot of strong women out there who can really work a pit and get some good food turned in, and they're winning contests. And those women are getting that respect. Though Mötley Crüe didn't win the grand championship at Peak City Pig Fest, Turner was happy to place second in chicken, third in ribs, and sixth overall out of 44 teams. Come Monday morning, when Turner returns to her day job, she's her office MVP. By the time she walks in, her co-workers have already placed dibs on the leftovers. A look now at the indie stage section. No mistakes, only solos. As science catches up with decades of anecdotal evidence that dance helps people with Parkinson's disease, local efforts converge at ADF. It's one thing to read an article in a medical journal about how dancing can assuage the symptoms of Parkinson's disease, but Susan Sanger, a dance and movement therapist with the American Dance Festival's Parkinson Movement Initiative, was watching it happen right in front of her. She and occupational therapist Lindsay Voorhees were teaching their dance for Parkinson class at Broad Street Studios using the soundtrack from The Music Man. At the end of the session, one student found she couldn't leave. She was frozen, a Parkinson condition in which the person's feet feel like they're glued to the floor. "Well, march out," Sanger said, and started singing 76 Trombones. The student immediately walked out of the room. The instructor's unconventional request lifted an everyday movement out of the woman's subcortex, where habitual gestures like walking are stored, and into the problem-solving cortex, a part of the brain unaffected by Parkinson's. "Anything that demands a new physical response is an answer to the problem," says Voorhees. "We ask, can you get from here to that counter to take your pills if you think of it as a dance?" And people have said, "Yes." Voorhees hastens to add that it doesn't work all the time, and that dancing doesn't represent a cure for the world's second most common neurological disease, which affects some 6 million people, most over the age of 60. But dance is one of the most immediate things that we know can really help people in their lives, Sanger says. "We already know a lot about what can enhance quality of life, and finding movement you love and engage in is consistent, and we know that it works." Science has been catching up with the anecdotal evidence suggesting that dance can not only make people with Parkinson's feel better, but also reduce the severity of their symptoms. Over the last decade, dozens of peer-reviewed articles have found that dancing can improve the motor and cognitive functions, mental symptoms, and quality of life among people with Parkinson's. In 2001, the Brooklyn Parkinson's Group proposed a dance class for its patients in the Mark Morris Dance Group, already one of the top modern dance companies at the time. As the classes properly spread and the research began confirming its medical effects, the company's Dance for Parkinson's program spread to 250 communities in 24 countries. Duke student Elena Jackson founded NC Dance for Parkinson's during her senior year in 2013 and recruited Voorhees and Sanger over the following years, first as volunteers and then as teachers. Last year, ADF began coordinating that effort with those of Pole Wellness Solutions into a cohesive program of weekly free classes at the festival's Broad Street Studios. a grant from the Parkinson Foundation, which funds from its annual Moving Day North Carolina Walk-Thon in Raleigh, made the series possible, including Sanger and Voorhees' dance classes. Pilates for Parkinson's, and workshops and outreach classes in Tai Chi and physical and musical therapy. According to the Julia Pleasance, ADF's community engagement manager, the initiative reached more than 130 people in its first year, which concluded in late June with a workshop in Argentine tango led by local dancer and cultural media director Muriel Elizion, who is also the only local choreographer on ADF's main stage season. The festival has applied for funds to continue the program after its summer hiatus. Sanger, Voorhees, and Pilates instructor Meg Poe resist labeling their classes as therapy. "People with Parkinson's are always going to therapy," Sanger said. "Their lives are filled with doctors, appointments. They don't want another therapy. They want to feel like they're just living their lives." That makes the ADF classes the anti-therapy, a room where people can leave Parkinson's and their usual roles as patients and caregivers at the door. Voorhees says the teachers attempt to create a space where there is a freedom from the limitations that Parkinson's can impose on the mind and the body. That space also has to suspend the judgment found in ordinary exercise classes. It takes the stress of, am I doing it right, away, and allows all of us to be in our own bodies however we can. In this class, there is no Parkinson's and no observers. There are only dancers. She pauses for a moment, grins, and adds, and there are no mistakes. There are only solos. How rare is such an environment for people with Parkinson's? A student in Poe's Pilates class told her, "This is the first time I felt I belonged somewhere in 6 months. Paula Easton, a neighborhood coordinator with Farrington Cares, says the ADF classes have been the beginning of a turnaround for me. When I left that first class, I called a friend and said, this is the most wonderful thing I could have found." Easton believes the classes have helped her keep her Parkinson at bay. "My muscle movement is better. My control of movement is better. My stiffness and muscle weakness are improving. And it helps with my body awareness. I just feel more in control of my movement and in everything that I do." Now from the indie music section, Zipped Up. Catherine Whelan's decade-long break from playing Squirrel Nut Zipper songs comes to an end. One of the most commercially successful bands to ever spring out of the triangle is Squirrel Nut Zippers, whose 1996 LP, Hot, sold more than 1 million copies. One of the group's not-so-secret weapons was Catherine Whelan, whose smoky, Billie Holiday-esque vocals gave the Zippers plenty of zing. In a chaotic radio landscape that is still reckoning with an abundance of moribund grunge, Whelan and company were an unexpected burst of fresh air. But the band's redneck Camelot, as drummer Chris Phillips described it in 2016, wouldn't last. Strained relationships within the band fractured it permanently. But on Saturday, after nearly a decade-long break from the Zippers, Whelan returns to some of the songs that changed the course of her life for good. This time, she's making them all her own. On the stage, though, she won't be entirely alone. Her friend Danny Gruen, who Whelan credits with reinvigorating her love of West Coast jazz, and banjo player Ellis Dyson have been learning these songs alongside her. "It's the songs, but it just feels different. It feels very natural and easy. Kind of like the very beginning days when we used to play in our living room out in Durham. And it was super organic and quiet," Whelan said. Her efforts to revisit those songs began when she and Dyson wanted to learn a song together. Waylon realized that the Zippers' Wash Jones, a banjo-driven tune written by frontman Jimbo Mathus that appears on the band's 1995 debut, would be a good fit for the pair. Jimbo had written it for a band that he was that was a sort of super punk band. They did a good version of it, but it wasn't exactly what he wanted, Waylon recalls. He was like, I want to play piano. Would you learn this on the banjo? And taught me that and made me feel so super cool and super powerful. And she and Dyson worked on the song. Waylon realized she wanted to build a full set. So she started searching for arrangement charts, digging up Danny Diamond and more. Some of her choices were dictated by which charts she could find, and Waylon had to listen to some of the songs on Spotify to jog her memory. Her set won't be limited to the tunes on which she sang lead. She's even likely to leave out some of the most well-known numbers that she sang over the years. It's worth noting, though, that she's planning on doing Hell, the band's massive hit penned by Tom Maxwell. The Zippers first went on hiatus in 2001 and reconvened for a few strings of shows between 2007 and 2009. Under Mathis's leadership, a version of the band sprung up again in 2016 in celebration of the 20th anniversary of Hot. He and drummer Phillips are the only original Zippers personnel to participate in the revival, which has remained active. Since retiring from the Zippers for good after the first reunion, Waylon has continued to make music under her own name and with Swedish Wood Patrol. She also ran a small business where she made hats and fascinators, many of which were made from parts of old unfinished quilt her aunt had given her. Upon returning to the Zippers catalog, Waylon says she hasn't encountered any uncomfortable feelings about it. I'm just going to sing, which is very refreshing. It was just kind of in there, and it didn't make me feel sad or bad. It was just kind of like, oh, it just made sense in a weird way, she said. When the Zippers were at their peak, Waylon says that an essential part of keeping her head on their shoulders was to play engaged with other music to help her improve her own craft. That's something she's held on to over the years. I would have gone crazy with the pressure of all the work if I hadn't always had something I was working on to get better. There would be whole tours where I would try to learn an entire Loretta Lynn record on my guitar in the bus, just to have something that I was working on, she said. It wasn't what we were performing, but it would inform it. I had to be learning. Most recently, she's fallen in love with a giant dog, the Austin, Texas rock renowned for its raucous, fast, and loose songs. She heard them on NPR's Sound Opinions and immediately became obsessed, as she put it. It triggered something in my mind of it, and you're going to perform, which I've been doing for a long time. Try to do something that people want to see and want to hear, she said. Waylon says she's gotten a blessing from Phillips and Mathis to do her Zippers show, which may be reprised later this year. Though she hasn't been in touch with the band's other members, she felt compelled to give the two active members a heads up. Jimbo had a band named the Squirrel Nut Zippers, and he's touring, so I didn't want it to be like I was trying to compete. I'm not a good liar. I'm not good at being dishonest or clouding things. I'm much better with things just being out in the open, she said. It could have been weird if they heard from somebody. Not that they're ever going to care or know. I just didn't want anybody to feel bad. Waylon herself is eager to return to the songs that have already been such a huge part of her life, especially when they still carry meaning for audiences decades later. People still have such a fond feeling for it, like, oh, I listened to that with my tiny baby dancing. Or I listened to that with my grandparents, she said. I knew the whole time that if you could do that and have every generation dig it, that was something. And I think that it's still happening. And now from the music brief column, Chris Brown still sucks. A comical side effect of the hashtag MeToo movement has been the concern that it'll ruin the lives and careers of powerful men. I say comical in the laugh to keep from crying sense, to see the utter failure of this feeble strain of whataboutism. We need to look no further than Chris Brown. On Tuesday, Brown headlines the Coastal Credit Union Music Park at Walnut Creek, which has a capacity of 20,000. He's still being afforded lucrative top-tier opportunities, and his songs still crack the Billboard Top 100, even after abundant documentation of his violent relationships with women. Photos of Rihanna's bloodied, battered face weren't enough to end Brown's career in 2009. In 2016, he punched a woman at a nightclub, and a few months later, he threatened another with a gun. Last year, the actress Khadij Tran won a 5-year restraining order against Brown after dating him on and off from 2010 to 2015. Even years after they'd broken up, Tran still felt like she needed to protect her safety, as she told talk show host Wendy Williams, and yet here comes Brown to sing and dance like there's nothing wrong. Certainly, Brown isn't the only man whose career has been more or less unaffected by women coming forward about the abuse they sought. Kelly still skulks across this horrible earth, and so does Woody Allen. The list is sickeningly long, and yet Brown and his miserable cohort can still book shows, make art, and exist in public. It's almost like none of it has ever happened. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. So, a reminder that this program is available on a podcast following its initial broadcast. Until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.